This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Trading Capes, When Villains Become Heroes.
I love that it's trading capes.
I was going to suggest trading hats, and then I thought, no, that just sounds a bit too mundane.
Trading hats.
Well, you know, white hat to black hat, and I was just like, no, no one's going to get that.
No, it's got to be the capes, doesn't it? And I think probably because of... I just love the fact that it's capes, because, of course, that's very synonymous with superheroes.
Utterly pointless piece of clothing.
They got it right in The Incredibles, the whole no capes.
It's like, yes, but they look all dashing. It's like, never mind. Like, sucked into a jet engine. Sucked into a jet engine. Sucked into a jet engine.
No, because I've been rewatching all of the recent Batman animated and Justice League animated movies from DC.
Yeah.
And I actually quite like them. I'm not a big fan in general of the DC the DC live action kind of stuff. I mean, I did my time watching The Flash, I still will go to the ends of the earth for Constantine, which was a great TV show, and I do like Titans. But in general, the live action stuff is not really my cup of tea for the most part. But their animated things are really, really good, and I really enjoy them. But I am just so amazed sometimes when you just see Batman running around with this huge sort of, it's all part of his look, and of course it does have its uses. I think it's kind of like part of, you know, extra body armor and stuff like that, and that he can throw it over his head, and you know, or it's fire retardant and you know, stuff like that. So that's good. It's like he's running around with a fire blanket, which is practical considering the guy is constantly blowing shit up. So on the one side, that's really practical. On the other side, he's meant to be uber, uber sneaky, sneaky. And yeah, I guess he can kind of disguise himself in the shadows with the whole, you know, with the cloak thing. But at the same time, whenever he's running around, his cloak is just flying out behind him.
And also you've got to think
around.
The number of times he goes in and out through doors or jumps off buildings or in and out of the Batmobile, and it never gets caught. It never gets stuck caught in a door.
Never. And the bit that amuses me is that, of course, you have, on a very practical level, you have Dick Grayson, first Robin. Now, he had a cloak too, but it was a lot shorter. Which made sense, considering this is an acrobat who's constantly running around and flipping through the air. And I think within the comics they actually do make an interesting point, which is that he, when he has to sort of don the Batman mantle, he's like, oh my god, Bruce's costume is so difficult to wear. Like, he really struggles with it, like they have to change, but he still keeps the bloody cape, doesn't he? And the whole thing, and it's ridiculous. Anyway, we're not talking about the way
clothing
that superheroes wear cloaks and capes. He is called the Caped Crusader as well, though, isn't he? So, you know, it's synonymous. And Batman really did start that look. I feel like Batman and Superman really, really kind of
I'm going to try and get you off capes for the moment. I've opened a can of worms with that title.
You have opened a can of worms. That being said, it is interesting. Can you think of? I mean, I know there are versions of not versions, but villains who wear capes as part of their general uniform.
Not really. They're more sort of parody villains.
Yeah. I mean,
generally, and you know, real villains tend to sort of go for the full on black robe and hood type thing if they're going for that sort of look at all.
Yeah, I mean, you do get it. I'm trying to think of how Loki dresses in Thor, because of course Loki is probably a really great example of that villain to hero. But is he a hero? No one really knows.
I'm gonna stop you there because we're gonna come to this in a little bit more order, I think.
Okay. All right. We haven't even
really explained what we're doing this episode. We've just talked about
capes. Okay. I'm sorry. I got excited.
Okay, save the excitement and parcel it out through the episode. this came about because I was watching the new animated series of She-Ra. Which I was really, really excited about, and I'm really enjoying it so far. Obviously, I grew up with the original, so it had a special place in my heart already. Look, there just weren't very many female heroes to identify with when I was growing up. And then to see that they remade and rebooted the series, and so far it's really good. There's lots of emphasis on friendship and on complicated moral choices and things like that. But it reminded me that one of my favourite all-time superhero villain type tropes is the one where your main character starts off believing that she is doing the right thing, but she's kind of been conditioned to work for the bad guys, which is what happens with Adora. Spoiler alert, presumably the new She-Ra is going to go pretty much the same backstory for She-Ra. Adora started off as Prince Adam's twin sister, who was randomly stolen by a minion of Hordak. Hordak is the evil guy for the planet Etheria. Mm-hmm. This is different to Eternia. So she wasn't just taken away from her family, she was taken away from her planet. From Eternia to Etheria. So this is so you can have He-Man on his planet and She-Ra on her planet, presumably.
Yeah, and they're not, you know, gonna...
Yeah. But what was interesting was where He-Man was just... literally did start off as just a way to sell 80s toys because they had too many Conan the Barbarian figures and they had to think of a way of selling them in a different way. I joke, not seriously. this is genuinely what it was. It was like the Conan the Barbarian figures weren't selling very well. It's like, how about He-Man? And someone just floated it, and then they created the comics and the cartoons and everything to go with it, and it really took off. That was mm-hmm. the 80s for you. She-Ra was different. She-Ra was a case of, oh my god, look at all these girls playing with He-Man toys. Perhaps girls like these kind of adventures too. Hey, why don't we aim something at girls? And that's where She-Ra came from. But they actually got women involved in creating the universe with She-Ra. And it was a lot more nuanced, a lot more characterization and things went into it. It was still a bit squicky, and if you look back at it now, it's kind of like, why has she always got perfect hair and makeup, even when she's having a fight? Why does she never really fight and roughhouse in the same way that the boys do, kind of thing? But ignore that. anyway, Adora's story is that she gets stolen away and brought up by Shadow Weaver. Obviously, guess which side Shadow Weaver's on?
I couldn't think.
As an adopted daughter of Hordak. Hordak is a minion of Horde Prime. And Horde Prime kind of stands for... It's this huge sort of, almost a bit like the Borg in the sense of the way that they see the universe as something to be taken and reshaped in the image that it wants, and it's all pollution and war, etc. Dominion, basically. And she excels, she gets promoted to like the first rank officer, and then she finally goes out into the Whispering Wood one day and realizes that the people that she's been fighting against, the people that she's been sending, you know, the soldiers in to like murder their families, etc., that they're actually just ordinary people. They're not these terrifying rebels. They're not people who are trying to upset the natural order. They're just literally trying to live, and they're fighting back because the Horde Prime is kind of sweeping across the planet and taking everything. Yeah. She discovers a magical sword. All the best stories. and realizes she's been lied to her entire life, and with quite a bit of struggle she gets the other side to accept her.
Wait, you mean I've been lied to by a person named Shadow Weaver as part of an organization called the Evil Horde? What?
It's like that David Mitchell sketch where it's like, you know how we've got skulls on our hats? Do you think maybe we're the bad guys? Yeah. No, and it is like that. A bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's a really interesting and quite fulfilling backstory, and I love that. And I realised that whenever I've got something that hits those notes in a book or a film or a series, it almost, that's an automatic, it gets me on board at least for a few episodes.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's one of my favourite tropes. And obviously I recommend the new She-Ra. It's really cool. I'm a nerd.
It is quite sweet, actually. I haven't been enjoying it. And they do discuss some interesting things. And that really is kind of what our episode is about. It's not actually about...
It's not actually about capes.
Cloaks and capes.
Yeah.
Though I wish it was. No, it's actually about the whole bad to good, the redemption arc. And yeah. Interestingly enough, I think actually the reason we're seeing a lot more of that in modern media is that we are moving away from this very Victorian, really, and really we can put it down to fairy tales. But it's this the very kind of black and white mentality, and it does, I think probably it does originate from fairy tales and the fact that you have the source of a lot of stories there. You know, fairy tales were adapted to be these kind of parables, these not parables, but you know, these moral stories, and in order to create this very obvious narrative, you have very obvious strings of association. So ugliness, wickedness is ugly and will always be defeated and can never find the light, and is also unfriendly and cruel, and innocence is beautiful and will always succeed, and this power of friendship, etc., etc., etc. What that fails to kind of comprehend, and actually probably adds to a lot of issues that we have now, is that that's really not how things work. Not in any kind of battle scenario, really. There are definitely psychopaths out there who fit the perfect, you know, who are basically, you know, Disney villains. Trump, for instance, is one of them. but regardless, the erasure of the fact that these are still human beings is a real problem. So we're starting to see this new kind of generation of writing, which is actually saying maybe it's not to do with good and evil. It's just about which side you fall on. And actually, goodness comes from within, and it also comes from a sense of opinion. So Adora is actually a great example, because she genuinely thinks she's doing the right thing. Now, I made that whole joke about the evil horde. That joke is actually in the new She-Ra, where she says, "You're part of the evil horde. What? Who calls us that? Everybody." You know, she just thinks they're called horde. And if this is language that she's been raised with, of course she's not going to associate it with negative things. You know, this, she's been part of a place where she's had a family, she's had friends, she gets on well with her teammates, who are actually relatively normal people, actually.
Yeah.
And she's got a great friendship with Catra, and you know, it's actually, I mean, I joke about the whole Batman thing, but really, if you look at the way the kind of the Robins were raised, yeah, Adora's been raised in a very similar way.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not quite brainwashing, but in a way, it's the sort of conditioning that all children experience to a greater or lesser extent as regards their own sort of parents' morality. And you look to your parents for that guidance as a child. So the whole She-Ra story is kind of like learning that the people you look to as parents aren't actually gods, and they're not right, and that maybe you need to make your own decision on what's right and wrong. And it's very difficult.
Yeah. And I do like it as well, because And I particularly like the way that they've done the new She-Ra, because they do really highlight the fact that sometimes you're just born on the wrong side. And you are brainwashed by the circumstances in which you grow up. Which you grow up in. So it's not really about good versus evil. I mean, in that sense, in the She-Ra version, it is good versus evil, because you do have the literal evil horde. You know, the dictator is obviously evil. But I think the reason we're seeing so many trends of actually kind of morally grey characters is because we're starting toward fiction which recognises that there is really no one side or another. There is a spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, the Horde itself and what it stands for is evil, but within the Horde, you know, the actual individual characters, they are varying shades, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it's a case of Catra in a different circumstance would probably be sort of, you know, one of the more negative good guys, but she's Catra's actually interesting because she's really looking for personal significance. And when personal significance, the quest for personal significance comes up against the quest for personal morality and wins, that's when you get somebody who starts to lean more towards the villain end of the spectrum, because they're putting their own desire for recognition above the fact that really we ought to be trying to be decent to each other.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really subtle little tipping point, but I think it's one of the steps on the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, absolutely.
Also, I love in She-Ra how when they're all like, talking about the terrible things that live in the Whispering Woods, there's princesses in there. And you're like, the first few times they say princesses, like they're talking about ogres. It's kind of a bit sort of, what are you talking about, princesses? And it's almost like retaking the word back and giving it new meaning.
Yeah, which is actually kind of fun.
Yes.
And I actually kind of like it, but yes. It was a bit jarring the first time. They're like, yeah, the evil princess. And I'm like, mm-hmm.
And obviously it was supposed to do that. It's supposed to make you go, what? What do you mean evil princesses?
Anyway, so She-Ra is a good example, but actually, if we go back to superheroes in general, we are getting a lot more examples of characters who are now kind of being redeemed back into heroes. And there's one I want to talk about, which is actually Red Hood.
Okay.
I mean, I'm on a Batman roll. It's really funny considering my opinions on Batman, but I'm on a roll. So actually, Red Hood is a really interesting character because he kind of swings like a pendulum between these circumstances. So for those who don't know the Red Hood, his name is Jason Todd, and he was the second Robin. Now, unlike Dick Grayson, who was picked up from the circus after watching his parents tragically killed right in front of him, and has a lot of parallels with Bruce Wayne and is very kind of no killing is wrong, except for the couple of times that he does it. But otherwise, you know, it's like a real moral thing for him. You have Jason Todd. Now, Jason Todd gets picked up to be Robin because Batman comes back from doing whatever he was doing and finds Jason Todd trying to steal his tires from the Batmobile.
Yeah.
Which I think is a great entrance for any character. Literally, Batman just stood there like, seriously? This kid is just there like,
It's like, just a second, I've almost got this bolt loose.
Could you just come back in like 2 minutes when I'm gone? And Batman's kind of like so astounded by this this behaviour that he just kind of goes, all right then. And just sort of ends up sort of taking Jason along with him. And so Jason becomes this new Robin. He's a lot more violent. He has a lot of anger. You know, he has a kind of a more of a criminal background. His father was a criminal. His mother is an addict. You know, he's had a really hard childhood. And he's a lot more violent, and he takes a lot more risks. And ultimately, he gets kidnapped by the Joker, which is never a good thing.
No.
And by popular demand, as in DC literally sent out a survey saying, should we kill him or not? And like a small majority managed to, you know, voted yes. And so they literally had him beaten to death with a crowbar, which is wow. Okay. And so Jason actually dies.
Yeah.
Ra's al Ghul then comes into the mix and goes, you know what? I'm gonna shit up. So he takes Jason Todd to the Lazarus pit and he brings him back to life. Jason is consumed at this point by this kind of maddening rage, which is fair enough. He did get killed by a supervillain and is trained in the art of killing everything and everybody. And he returns to Gotham as the Red Hood, where he basically promptly takes up position as a crime mob boss because he realizes that you can't actually stop crime Batman's way, but you can control it. So he goes around basically murdering all the bad villains and controlling all of the kind of the more sort of, you know, so-so villains so that he can stop things like sex trafficking and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he is undoubtedly a bad guy with maybe a little bit of goodness on the spectrum. In recent versions, however, Red Hood has kind of come back to be part of the so-called Bat family, in that you do see him working a lot more alongside of, you know, Nightwing and Red Robin, whereas before, literally what happened was he tried to kill Batman, he tried to kill all of them. Then when Batman supposedly died, he tried to take over as the new Batman and almost killed both Damian Wayne and Tim Drake. And he was just altogether not a great guy. And now he's suddenly a family man again.
Yeah.
And I like that, personally. But that's like a real, you know, 180.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Because you have people who literally start off in the villain camp, not knowing that they are villains, and move over to the good guy side, which is basically what happens with Dora.
Yeah.
And then you have people who can start off in the good guy camp, and through one decision or another, they end up becoming the bad guys, which is another really interesting arc. And then you've got the guys in the middle who kind of go backwards and forwards, you know? They keep stepping back and forth across the line. They've never really picked a side. Like Magneto, I'm better at the Marvel Universe. Magneto's quite a, particularly lately, he's quite a good example of this.
Yes, Magneto's a really interesting character because he's, I think he's the perfect example of someone who, he's an extremist. That's the thing about Magneto, he's an extremist. And so some of his philosophy, some of his feelings and thoughts, they're not wrong, but he's taking them to an extreme. To the point that he's basically create this very, he's the one who's creating this very cut and dry us versus them universe. And from his perspective, he is entirely in the right. He's basically saying, we are the minority, we are being hunted, we are being discriminated against. This can only end when our suppressors are destroyed.
Yeah.
So you can definitely understand kind of where he's coming from. But it does mean that every now and again, when there are certain situations call for it, he kind of puts his idealism to the side and his, you know, he basically puts all those things to the side and he will come in to the rescue. But inevitably, you know what will happen. And it's the same with Loki, is that just you're always like, yeah, Magneto, or yeah, Loki, you're on the right path, you're doing the right thing. And then the first opportunity to fuck it all up, and they're like, whoop whoop.
Yeah, it's
back
almost like
to my old ways.
Yeah, it's that Aesop's fable about the fox and the scorpion, isn't it? And it's like, well, it's my nature. It's like, I'm the god of mischief. What did you expect?
Seriously,
me to do?
What did you expect?
X-Men actually have so many of these characters that step back and forth, back and forth across the line. Yeah, there's Emma Frost as well. There's Gambit. Gambit actually starts off as a pretty dark guy. Quicksilver, which you'd expect with him being Magneto's son. Mystique. Yeah. Mystique's a really interesting one. Rogue and Jean Grey. Jean Grey, it's not entirely her fault, in fairness.
Yeah, there's the whole kind of Phoenix thing going on there. Yeah. It's pretty tough on her.
And obviously you've got Black Widow as well. Black Widow starts off as a really, really dyed-in-the-wool bad guy.
Yeah, but I mean, Black Widow is full on a Russian spy.
And assassin, and it's
And an
only when the
assassin.
K it's only when the KGB fucks her over, she's kind of like, okay, I'm going to go and work for the other side. And she literally does it in a kind of fuck you kind of way. Talks
Yeah.
her way onto the team eventually, and then sort of grows a conscience very, very slowly after that.
Yeah. And the way that a kind of a lot of people have kind of managed to overcome her history whilst maintaining it in the current adaptations, where she's obviously on the side of good, is that, they really bring in that whole kind of I was brainwashed, I was brought up by this.
Yeah.
And then I think that's actually a nice part of the way that comics work. On the one side, comics are so infuriating because what's the one storyline? Oh my God. It keeps being rewritten. Like, just as an example, do you know how many birthdays Dick Grayson has? Do you know how many birthdays Dick Grayson has? Too many, okay? For one kid, he has way too many. And it's because they keep being rewritten and the Earth keeps being destroyed, or there's alternative universes and there's different timelines and there's different versions. There's 52 or whatever, anyway. So you have all these different versions and it's really hard to follow them. But on the other side, it's like a glorified world of fan fiction, because that's literally what it is. None of these people writing the current stuff are really, many of them didn't create any of these characters. They are picking them up from somebody else and they're continuing on with the story. And it gives this great potential to reinvent characters, to keep them current, and to basically look at stories which are going to be relevant for the modern day. So it's great in that sense. And it does mean that, yeah, we can actually take a character who we like and say, actually, let's make them a good guy. It's the ultimate alternative universe fan fiction.
Yeah, it's like another good example. I know we all love the new humorous, pansexual, flamboyant Deadpool. Who doesn't? I certainly do. But he started off as a mercenary for hire who killed people for money. He was a genuinely bad guy.
The thing about Deadpool, the thing about Deadpool was, first of all, he was based on Slade Wilson, which is I don't know if I've seen the clip of the Teen Titans Go movie where they break in on Slade stealing something and they're like, Deadpool? He's like, what? No, I'm not Deadpool. And yeah, the
I'm
joke is I'm like,
Deathstroke.
I'm Slade. But it's yeah, but literally Wade Wilson's. Was based off of Slade
Slade
Wilson.
Wilson.
Like, their names aren't even, like, they just changed two letters. That's incredible.
No one was even really trying that
No one was
day.
even trying. Their costumes kind of look the same. Their fighting styles are the same. They even have kind of relatively similar sort of powers. But of course, Deadpool takes it to the extreme in that he's ultimately can heal up from pretty much everything. And the thing about Deadpool is that he actually kind of started off as quite a straight guy. Much like Wade Wilson, so he was just a bad guy. He was just that mercenary, and then he—I think it was just one comic book which changed everything, where he started to basically break the fourth wall, and that changed everything. And he became this iconic character. And I think ultimately what happened was that people—I mean, we love villains. Everyone loves a good villain. But if you consistently have a villain that continues to just be villainous, we kind of want redeeming features in them, I think. I mean, some people just want them to always continue to be villainous forever. But on the whole, I think that we actually kind of get quite sort of like, I want to be able to justify why I like them. I want them to be good people as well. And so it just takes a small, you had a tiny moral component. And the thing about obviously making Wade Wilson a mercenary for hire was that, that's cold. But it did leave wiggle room for him to be able to be a good person. He wasn't just a psychotic killer going around doing it for fun. He was doing it for money. And then all it would take is, no, I only take certain jobs. No, I only kill certain scumbags. And it's actually very easy to wiggle him into not a hero, but like a relatively good character. And the whole Deadpool movies are all about him sort of becoming that
He's
hero whilst also maintaining that, but I am going to kill a guy.
Yeah, and it's brilliant. I love that. He's absolutely certain that he's going to, you know, walk that grey path in the middle, and I'm down for that. But slightly different, the Punisher. Because
yeah.
Technically, the Punisher's supposed to be a good guy, but he's really not.
He isn't. I mean, the thing with the Punisher is that it's a little bit, again, he kind of falls into the same camp as the Red Hood. And it's like there's four different camps. You've got just the heroes, which is we never kill. You have the extremist heroes. You have the mercenary baddies who can do good. I mean, even Slade Wilson occasionally will work with the heroes. You know, he has this weird relationship with the Bat family in particular, in that it's sort of like friendly antagonism to, you know, full-on hatred. And then you have just the kill them all villains. The extremist villains, Deadpool falls into the kind of the mercenary villain. And Red Hood and the Punisher fall into that extremist superhero, whereby they are doing what they ultimately believe to be good, but in a bad way. And they recognize that it's a bad way most of the time, but they also say this is the only way that ultimately things can get better.
Yeah, it's quite a brittle form of morality in the sense of, you know, you're one sneeze away from a killing spree. So something comes and totally changes your worldview, and you don't have the facility to adapt to that change in a way that allows for your morality to grow around it. So instead, you're like, well, if I can't be that good, I'm going to be as bad and damned doing what I think is right as I possibly can be.
Yeah. And it is actually interesting because in terms of the way DC and Marvel handle it, the main leaguers in DC, so the main superheroes, have a kind of a very different approach to the main superheroes in at least the Marvel MCU. So in DC, you've got the very much we don't kill kind of mentality. And if you kill, then you're kind of out of the club, if that makes sense.
Yes.
You know, that's very in keeping with the Justice League kind of memo. Even though they have like characters who did originally kill, like Wonder Woman, I don't think she really minds about killing, to be honest. She's a warrior. It's pretty, you know, in there. But, you know, for the most part, they just don't kill. They kind of follow their mentality. And if you do, then you're not really a superhero as far as they're concerned. You're sort of like a vigilante. Then you get Marvel. And Marvel do it quite differently. Like, Tony Stark kills a bunch of people in that first movie. Captain America kills a bunch of people. Like, they're all out there killing people. But they're unnamed people, so I guess it's okay.
I think it's really interesting to look at whether someone is the villain simply because someone else took the position of being the ultimate hero. I'm thinking of the DC comic Red Sun, whereby Superman didn't land in America. He landed in communist Russia and was brought up to Russian communist ideals. And Lex Luthor, who, you know, was a genius and everything, ends up leading the resistance against him on the other side. He's the only one who can come up with ways to stop him. It's a really fascinating look at how, under different circumstances, Lex Luthor, whose real character arc is this search for personal significance to be the best that he can be. But when Superman's in America, then, you know, in the storyline where Superman is found in Kansas, Lex Luthor can't ever be the best because Superman's there. But whereas Superman's the bad guy over in communist Russia, Lex Luthor gets to be the good guy.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see how, I mean, ultimately, that makes him a very muddy good guy, I guess, because if you cannot put aside your ego long enough to say, well, maybe my personal significance doesn't matter as long as there's someone out there who's making sure that everything's, you know, is out there doing good work and I can do good on a different level,
yeah,
then yeah, it's all about ego, isn't it? But rather than
it's
morality.
Also about, I mean, there is a kind of a racist component that definitely comes along with the whole battle between Luther and Clark Kent. There is a racial component, which they do bring out in, you know, a lot of the movies as well, which is that Clark is literally an alien. And of course, this is significant in the time when you think about the fact that the way that Superman looks, this is a guy with black hair. Now, that may not seem that significant, but, you know, this is coming out of a time where you had the whole Aryan race kind of thing. And, I mean, even if you look at sort of the way that Captain America looks, he is the typical American hero. He has the blonde hair, the blue eyes. Whereas Clark Kent is an alien, he's got black hair, there's, you know, obviously it's not exactly tied, but it was synonymous, of course, with being Jewish. And I just think, you know, that, and I'm pretty sure that actually Superman was created by two Jewish writers.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Yeah. So there is the whole kind of, yeah, he's an alien, we can't trust him. Only I am, you know, homeborn. I am the one who should protect this country, not him. So there's a component of that as well. And so, yeah, I can definitely see why it's interesting, the idea of, yeah, if Superman had been brought up under different circumstances, he could have been someone very dangerous and someone, you know, very scary, because, of course, the whole what is right, what is wrong, and who is right and who is wrong all depends on the way that you were raised. But I do think, you know, the whole, that is actually one of the main components of the Superman story, is actually help can come from where you least expect it.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, moving away from comics for a little bit, I want to talk about Star Wars and also Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Okay.
So Star Wars, obviously I would have started from the position of the original Star Wars trilogy, where you have Darth Vader, who, you know, in my childhood was one of the scariest villains imaginable, until you actually really got to see the Emperor do something. And it was quite a significant moment, I think, in terms of understanding character, without even realising that's what I was doing, because I'd have been about 7 or 8. Mm. Was when Luke refuses to strike down Darth Vader because he's his father. And obviously, spoilers, but if you haven't seen these films, guys, seriously, what have you been doing?
I mean, if you don't already know.
Yeah. And it's one of those ones that resonated and stayed with me for a really long time. And the fact that someone who could go that far wrong and yet still come back from it, and then they expanded on it, admittedly not in a brilliant way in the prequel trilogy, but it was still interesting, the storyline of how he started going down that path. Now, personally, I thought the little flashes of ego and the recognise me, recognise how good I am, recognise my personal significance, recognise that I am the chosen one, etc. And it's all going downhill right up to the point where it's like, yeah, it's totally logical for me to go and slaughter a temple full of younglings. I'm not the bad guy. I'm just setting the universe how it's supposed to be. It didn't entirely resonate with the character that we come to know later on. However, I do think that's an interesting point, because he started off from the position of everybody's got these great hopes for him. And to the point where we think he's got too much power and we're a little bit afraid of him, so we're going to try and keep him in his place. You can't abdicate him of all responsibility for that, but it was definitely, it made it easier for Palpatine to get his hooks in him, I think, personally.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about Annie was, first of all, I think he had too much sand in his brain. I think that can affect a person's behaviour. Being raised in a desert definitely affects your behaviour. I'm with him on the whole sand thing. Like, he is right about that. But no, seriously, the Jedi are not good people.
No, they're not. I mean, Mace Windu, he's another one who's like, you're two sneezes away from massive killing spree yourself. You just happen to be on the side of the light and the righteous right now.
Yeah, like, they're really not good people. There's a lot of mind control going on there. It's and the whole kind of repression of emotions as well. Like, they really do not teach Anakin to deal with his emotions well at all. Which probably doesn't help, and as I say, it really does mean it's very easy for him to be manipulated. But also, you know, I think there's probably an element of mind control happening there as well. Well, like, certainly. I refuse to believe that he was just randomly having nightmares. Like, I think there's, you know, there's manipulation there that's happening.
But then they say that, you know, the Force will show you things that could happen that you're afraid of. So it unless you learn to deal with the possibility that you cannot control everything.
Yeah.
And that was the problem. He would not yield to that. Which is understandable, because let's face it, the first time Luke sees his friends in trouble through the Force, through Force vision, he kind of goes, oh, well, sorry, Yoda, I'm off. And Yoda's like, yeah, if you go, then you're going to probably end up going over to the dark side. I'm not sure, but, you know, probably. And Luke's like, no, I'm going anyway.
But I'm going to do it anyway.
But the important thing is that Yoda doesn't try to stop him at that point. It's kind of like, okay, well, obviously I can't stop you. You just need to be aware.
Yeah, but, I just feel like maybe if the Jedi's had some sort of counselling option, that might have helped. Also, if instead of, you know, seeing a tiny child and saying, the fate of the universe rests on your hands, maybe just don't do that.
Yeah, you know, accept him, give him family, and so anyway, the whole Jedi training thing, as is explored in the sequel trilogy, is like, no, you know what? That was kind of a fucked up way of doing things. We got it wrong. We really got it wrong. We continued to get it wrong. Moving quickly to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, obviously the two big redemption arcs there. Actually, there's three really, but ignore Willow for now because that's a very particular redemption arc. Angel and Spike, and yeah, I do have a little bit of eye rolling kind of going on for Angel, because it's the whole, you have to remember that when Buffy originally came out, the whole tortured vampire with a soul thing was still fairly new, you know. It hadn't been redone in hundreds of thousands of paranormal romance novels whereby the brooding vampire gets saved by the clueless beauty kind of thing, and it was, I wouldn't necessarily say it was done particularly well with Angel, but he does attain some kind of self-recognition in the sense of, you know what, ultimately, there's no reward for this. There's no reward except to be a decent person or try to be a decent person in its own right. Whereas Spike was a little bit different, and I felt that Spike had more agency because he actually went and got his soul back. Possibly for the wrong reasons, but he did go and do it himself. He wasn't cursed with it.
It's interesting as well, because actually I think I did see spokespeople for Buffy basically saying that given time, Spike would have ultimately been a better partner for Buffy.
Yeah.
And I can definitely kind of understand that. It might also have a large part to do with who they were before they got turned. And there was an element of rebellion and anger about Angel as a character before he was turned.
Yes.
Whereas Spike was just a bit of a nerd.
That was the thing, though. I mean, as is pointed out in a particular episode, it's like, yes, and what a man you were, a drunken, whoring layabout. Whereas Spike was just guilty of being a bit of a boring mummy's boy.
Yeah. He just liked his books and stuff like that.
But literally the first thing Spike does as a vampire is turn his mother so they can be together forever. Which is fucked up on a completely different level. But at the same time, you'd naturally have a bit more sympathy for him. He becomes really bad. They both do.
Yeah. But it is, you know, his actions are very much down to the fact he doesn't have a soul. And so it kind of is excusable. It's a form of madness, really. He's not kind of accountable for his actions because he literally completely lacks any form of empathy. And not only does he lack any form of empathy, he lacks the capacity in which to care about that. And not through any choice of his own, either. And it is actually, despite being in that state, he makes the choice to get that empathy back.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, if you're a Buffy nerd, then, and you dig a lot into the sort of backstories and things like that, you learn that the sort of demon that's attracted to you when you become a vampire is actually one that's compatible with your basic personality.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you don't have the moral component, you don't have a natural inclination towards compassion or whatever. But it is noticeable that while Spike does very bad things, he does good things as a vampire as well. Usually in the enemy of my enemy is my friend type sense, but it's noticeable when Angel as Angelus is like, yeah, let's get the judge and blow up the world and destroy everything, which is really, really stupid, by the way. Spike's kind of like, I still really hate the Slayer, but I'd rather work with her to stop this because I kind of like the world the way it is.
Yeah. He's being relatively sensible.
Yeah. So ultimately, if we're looking at it as a, you know, hero, as a villain accidentally becoming a hero, there's Spike, and then he does it more deliberately with more agency, and ultimately, you know, basically dies at the end of the seventh season. We know what happens after that, but it's a more satisfying redemption arc than Angel's, I think. Because Angel's redemption arc is kind of like, this has been forced on you. And he does spend an awful lot of time moping about the things he's done. And he's done terrible things, but he doesn't really help anyone. He mopes about it.
Well,
literally,
I mean,
he mopes for decades at one point.
Yeah, but I mean, he does set up the whole kind of, you know, in Angel, his whole kind of shtick is about the fact that he knows he's trying to redeem himself.
Yeah, but the thing is, he doesn't do that by himself either, does he? I mean, you start off by seeing that Whistler, this random demon person, comes along and says, yeah, you should help out the Slayer. So he goes off and spies on Buffy when she's 15 and realises she's going to go to Sunnydale, etc. And he's going to go and help. And then later moves to Los Angeles. And again, he's kind of doing a few random things, but he's disconnected with people. And then you get Doyle who comes along.
Yeah.
He never really organises until you get Doyle and Cordelia and a few others sort of coming in and saying, you need human contact because otherwise things are going to go very badly.
Yeah, true.
He's an apathetic good guy in a lot of ways. In my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And yeah, ultimately we do know how that all ends.
Yes, we do. I'm just going to mention a book by, because we've mostly mentioned TV series and cartoons so far.
And comics,
yep. True. Legend by Mary Lou, which is kind of a dystopian partial retelling of Les Miserables, whereby you have this girl who is basically a absolute genius, top of her class type. She's literally sort of what we'd call a police officer, but she's an enforcer. And she's set to track down this repeated and unrepentant thief type person. Obviously, he and she, you can see where that's going, can't you? There's going to be a romantic plot there.
Yeah.
I've not read the second two books in the trilogy, but what I found interesting was, and what got me into the book in the first place, was it does literally start from the position of her thinking that in serving this high empire type society, that she was doing the absolute best she could do. And it was only in being thrown together with this thief guy that she realises that actually the people she served do a lot of bad things. And she had no idea how the people who were considered the lower castes, actually survived. And the fact that a lot of them don't, and, you know, live in terrible conditions.
Mm.
And, it, you know, it's, again, it's kind of like that Adora, oh, I thought I was working for the good guys, but hey, I guess I wasn't. Maybe I should be working with you. she's intelligent, but she's moral with it as well. So that was interesting. Obviously, in the actual book, Les Miserables, Inspector Javert never, ever comes to the point where he thinks that Jean Valjean was actually in the right. or that, you know, that his villainy was actually, shall we say, understandable, and that this wasn't a bad man. And when Javert finds out that actually he's kind of been the bad guy all along, his mind kind of breaks, and he's a case of, no, I'm not going to have it, I'm going to commit suicide and throw your gift back in your face, kind of thing. So, yeah, it is interesting. And it's also interesting in the sense of, as we've mentioned earlier, that with the Jedi, for example, that extreme goodness can be just as terrible as extreme evil. That extreme righteousness can be just as damaging, particularly if you really buy into what you're selling.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think ultimately it comes down to the fact that we like to feel... Well, first of all, I think that storytellers like to remind people that actually we could be the villains.
Yeah.
Of any story. And I think that when you invest so much time in creating characters, especially in universes which have lots and lots of characters, and that's, you know, particularly true of TV series, sort of epic fantasy and comic books, when you have so many characters, it just doesn't make sense that they're all just raving maniac lunatics who just want to destroy the world. You know, they can't all be Darkseid. All right, they can't all just be the devil. You've got to have this in between. And the characters which are going to stick with you are the characters which are ultimately going to be more human and who you feel like actually you can understand. And having tiny redeeming features, first of all, makes the character even more uncomfortable, I think, because there's nothing worse than you totally wanting to hate somebody. I mean, for example, how uncomfortable is it when you see pictures of Hitler doing very human, normal things?
Oh, like when he was... That one I've seen where he's flirting with Eva Braun.
Yeah,
And it's kind of like, that's... Yeah, if you're... And you are literally told, basically, at school that this was a very evil man, etc., etc. You're not given much nuance. And you forget that... Yeah, he was still capable of human emotion.
He was. And the thing is, like, we don't want to imagine that he was capable of human emotion. It kind of makes it worse, because you suddenly think, God, that was a human being who committed those things.
Yeah, it's a monster.
It's very easy. Yeah, not a monster. And you kind of have to remember the human capacity to do evil, which is a very uncomfortable kind of thing, because it almost makes it more unbelievable, because you think, how could someone like me do something like that? So on the one side, I think having these very human traits makes things way more, makes villains way scarier, makes the whole situation a lot more uncomfortable. But also for characters who you want to have nuance and who you want to be interesting, having that ability to maybe do good really makes them very interesting. It makes them more likable. And I don't know about you, but I kind of like having a few likeable sort of villains. I mean, within the Hamartia cycle, there are only really two big bad guys. And one of them is De Giles.
I'm going to say De Giles is not likable on any level.
Yeah, De Giles is not likable on any level. But De Giles is actually pretty much the only psychotic character, as in he's a genuine psychopath. He he's just obsessed with doing his experiments, has absolutely no empathy. He's just an all-round bad guy. And the other one, of course, is the King of Cathra, who we haven't really seen yet. He's also a bad guy. But among the other, and there are some other really nasty characters throughout. I mean, even Sverin in the second book is not a great person. He's not very nice. But he still has that humanity to him, which is being rapidly kind of taken away. But he does still feel. And he is actually kind of confused by what's happening. And even though I don't like him as a person, I do like him as a character, and it was important to me to demonstrate that this was a human being, and that he has very real, maybe not reasonable, but very real reasons for doing what he does, and for acting in the way that he does. You know, these things don't just happen because you snap your fingers. If you want characters to be truthful, you have to face the reality that not everyone can be a psychopath, and sometimes bad people are bad because of the things that happen to them. And whether that's, you know, excuses what they're doing, which, you know, I'd always argue that it doesn't, you still need to understand why they're doing it, how they can justify their behaviour, what's led to it. And having those kind of components, I think, it often if people feel very sympathetic for a character and the way that they've behaved, they want to see them redeemed, and they want to see them kind of go over to the other side and say, actually, ultimately, you are a good person, and I want you to be a hero, and I want you to get along with all of the other hero characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends how it, for me personally, I mean, it depends how it's handled, because yes, sometimes people act the way they do because of things that have happened to them, but ultimately, I think people act the way they do because of things that happen to them because of the way they process that. People who do have some decent moral strength tend to not just go out and just spread the pain around, you know? They find other ways of processing it. That's not to say good people don't do bad things, bad people don't do good things, etc. It's never black and white. But it's much more, as you say, satisfying to have those little pinches of humanity in a villainous character, because otherwise they're just two-dimensional and they're flat. And as you say, not everybody can just be a case of, oh, well, you came out of the bun tin slightly wrong. And clearly you're not even bothered by the fact that you have a lack of empathy. You're aware that you have a lack of it, and you don't care, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Fairly few people are actually really like that. I suppose one thing that I do find as a side trope is you've, and we've both, in fact, said many times before that everyone's the hero of their own story, so the villain might not even think they're the villain. However, what's really interesting to me is when you see a hero realising that they are the villain in someone else's story, and that actually they're quite scary to the person that is on the opposite team.
Yeah.
And not in a, ha ha ha, the bad guys shall run from me for their evil, but in the sort of like, no, genuinely, they see you as the villain. They see you as the bad guy. That's always a really satisfying one as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I do like that as well. And the kind of the, oh, God, I'm scary. I don't mean... They did an interesting thing. There's a new movie is coming out, and I've just forgotten what it's called. But it's a kind of a relook at the Superman origin story, but as a horror movie instead.
Really? I've not heard of this.
it's called... hold on a second. Because I watched the trailer last night and I was like, holy shit. Horror movie. What's it called? Yeah, it's called Brightburn.
Right.
And it's by James Gunn. So I think that's, yeah, a guy who was involved with Guardians of the Galaxy, so this is going to be interesting. But yeah, it takes a whole new look at the whole origin story of your parents find the alien child, and the alien child has got strange powers, except instead of ultimately being good, this alien child is terrifying. I really recommend you go and watch the trailer, because you're like, okay, oh my god, I never knew that the whole Superman thing could be so scary. And it's not Clark Kent, it's a different character, obviously. But they have actually handled it really well. And it does make, you know, the good point, which is that Superman as a character is really scary.
And what's it called?
Brightburn.
Brightburn, right, okay.
Brightburn, yeah, highly recommended. And actually, kind of the whole... So the Soviet Accords in the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe really highlights that particularly well. The whole sort of, but you do realise you're a bunch of superpowered people and that you're actually kind of scary. And actually, they did it I think, oh god, I can't remember which one it's called. Yeah, that's it. It's Justice League Doom. The whole movie is that Vandal Savage and his a bunch of other not very nice people all get together to kind of defeat the Justice League, and they steal the plans from Batman has, the contingency plans Batman has to get rid of the Justice League.
Yeah.
And when the Justice League find out that Batman's basically planned on ways to get rid of them, he's like, well, first of all, those are plans were just to, you know, subdue you. They weren't meant to kill. They were clearly altered. And then Justice League are like, oh my god, that's such a breach of trust. And, you know, what do you have to say for yourself? And Batman's like, I'm not saying anything. Like, of course we need to have contingency plans. And they're like, what, you think we're going to go evil? He's like, well, yeah, you could. Or you could get mind controlled or something like that. Like, I'm not going to apologize for recognizing the fact that you are a bunch of high-powered individuals who can destroy the world if you want to. Like, we've got to recognize that. And then that great line at the end where Superman's like, oh, how arrogant are you that you didn't even create a contingency for yourself? And Batman's like, dude, I do have a contingency. It's literally called the Justice League. At which point I want to point out, of course, that is a terrible contingency considering the fact that he's already figured out how to take them all out. So anyway, that's not the point. The point is that I like the fact that they highlighted, yeah, just because they are the good guys technically doesn't mean that there isn't an insane capacity or opportunity for them to do very, very serious damage.
Definitely. Anyway, on that note, I think we need to wrap it up for this week.
Yeah, we barely got to talk about capes.
We did talk about capes for a good 5 minutes. Would you like to do an episode on superhero clothing? Because we can totally do that.
Yes, let's talk about clothing!
The haute couture of the superhero. Yeah, okay, expect that in a forthcoming episode, guys.
Before we go, though, of course, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
I have. It's an animated series called Big Mouth. It couldn't be further away from what we've been discussing this week, to be honest. It's really interesting and funny and intelligent. And basically, it follows a group of 12 to 13-year-old kids as they tackle puberty, which sounds like a terrible idea for an animated series, but it's done so hilariously funny. For example, basically the first episode, the puberty monster turns up for one of the characters, and he does look a bit sort of demonic, and he turns up and nobody else can really see him unless they happen to be going through puberty with the male puberty monster as well. And right. He's whispering suggestions and things, which are really off colour, but a kind of like an insight to the 13-year-old male mindset. And then the female puberty monster turns up in another episode with one of the female characters. And it's kind of like a lot of that's quite accurate. A lot of that's kind of like, yeah, that's okay. I mean, maybe not the tantrums and things for me personally, but some of the rest of it's kind of like, yep, totally get that. The rage, the rage is definitely a thing. And it is just really funny. And as you go on through the first season, it ends on a really epically great one, which looks at consent. And I don't know, I think it's one of the most sex positive and intelligent and funny shows about sort of tackling that era of your life. Something to look back on a bit fondly. I mean, imagine if you're right in the middle of it at the time, it's actually not that funny because you're already dealing with your own puberty monster. But
yeah.
Anyway, seriously, I recommend it. It's very, very funny.
Okay. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.